The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the June 3rd, 2022 issue of the Week magazine. The cover this week is a photograph. On the far right, sitting is a Hispanic man. He's got a very, very sad look on his face. He's got his phone in his left hand and a flower in his right hand. Leaning into him is a teenage girl, tissue in her hand. She's distraught and sobbing. The headline in huge font is, "Again, is America powerless to halt the endless heartbreak of mass shootings?" That is our first story. We'll start with that. Anger and heartache after another school massacre. What happened? America's decade-long debate over gun safety laws received a horrifying jolt of urgency this week after an 18-year-old gunman killed 19 children and two teachers in a Texas elementary school. It was the second mass shooting in the U.S. in 2 weeks and the deadliest school shooting since 2012's Sandy Hook Elementary School massacre. Wearing body armor and wielding a semi-automatic assault-style rifle, Salvador Ramos shot his way past three armed police officers to enter Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, Texas, and opened fire in two adjoining classrooms, killing 19 third and fourth graders and two teachers. As 10-year-old Amari Jo Garza tried to dial 911, witnesses said he told her, "You're going to die," and shot her. The shooter's hour-long rampage ended only when a Border Patrol tactical unit raced to the school and an agent shot Ramos dead. At a civic center in Uvalde, a rural, poor, majority Latino town 75 miles from the Mexican border, sobbing parents were swabbed for DNA to identify the victims, some of whom were left unrecognizable by bullets. Screams periodically erupted as some received confirmation that their children were among the dead. The shooter brought two assault rifles and 375 ammunition rounds days after his 18th birthday last week, police said. He shot and critically wounded his grandmother before driving to the elementary school 2 days before summer recess. Other family members and former friends said he had been bullied for a lisp and a stutter, had stopped attending high school, and had become increasingly angry and violent. At a Wendy's restaurant where he worked, he reportedly threatened and sent inappropriate texts to female coworkers. In response to the nation's 27th school shooting this year, President Biden urged lawmakers to take action. "When in God's name are we going to stand up to the gun lobby?" he said. "Where in God's name is our backbone?" Texas Governor Greg Abbott, who signed 22 laws loosening gun restrictions over the past year, said the massacre was caused by the evil in the shooter's heart. What the editorial said. "This is national suicide," said the Los Angeles Times. "This is what we have become. We can't muster enough political will to make our leaders enact sensible gun control measures, even after gun violence became the number one cause of deaths among children under 18, we are quite literally killing our future." "Governor Abbott has let us down," said the Houston Chronicle. He said the Uvalde shooting happened horrifically, incomprehensibly, but it is hardly incomprehensible that gun violence is rampant in a state with gun laws so lax they've even defied the objections of police chiefs. the Second Amendment can coexist with reasonable gun control. We desperately need some sanity. What the columnist said, it doesn't matter whatever confection of hate and cruelty drove the latest killer to wage war on 9- and 10-year-old children, said David Frum in The Atlantic. Public policy put the weapon of mass murder into his hands. Other nations also have disaffected or mentally ill young men, but they make some considerable effort to keep guns away from them. During the pandemic, firearm sales reached record highs, 20 million in 2020, 18.5 million in 2021. Easy access to guns and not evil or mental illness explains our descent into barbarism and the spectacular human butchery of our recurring mass slaughters. Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton has a solution, said Steve Bannon in MSNBC.com. We can't stop bad people from doing bad things, Paxton said after the massacre, but we can potentially arm and prepare and train teachers. This ignores the fact that the shooter outgunned three cops, wounding two. And saying that you can't stop bad people from committing gun massacres is actually an argument against all laws. Democrats' go-to solution would not have changed the outcome, said Jim Garrity in National Review. Ramos purchased his firearms legally after turning 18 and does not appear to have a criminal record. So a conventional background check would not have prevented this tragedy. Democrats love to claim that popular will is being thwarted by a powerful special interest group, said Tim Carney in the Washington Examiner. But the National Rifle Association is now at least matched in spending by well-funded groups such as Michael Bloomberg's Everytown for Gun Safety. The real reason gun control laws meet such fierce resistance is cultural. For many Americans, owning guns is a mindset and a way of life. Would Republicans be helplessly throwing up their hands if 19 kids died because of police budget cuts, said William Salatin in The Bulwark? Of course not. They'd be in front of every camera and microphone today, pounding Democrats for defunding police. Nothing will change until the enemies of law and order, who encourage gun sales no matter how many people die, start losing their jobs. The controversy of the week is COVID. Denial in the face of a sixth wave. Most Americans don't realize it, said Rachel Rubin in the Washington Post. But COVID is back. A new highly transmissible subvariant of Omicron, BA.2.1.2.1, has evolved to evade prior immunity and is rapidly spreading across the country. The number of new reported infections in the U.S. has climbed back to more than 100,000 a day, and because most people do not report their home test, experts say the actual number could be 500,000 to 1 million new cases a day. Deaths in this silent surge are still relatively low, about 350 a day. But hospitalizations have risen by more than 20% over 2 weeks. Even though no one wants to admit it, the U.S. is actually in the midst of a sixth wave, said Aaron Prater in Fortune. By standards the Centers for Disease Control abandoned in March, at least 63% of the country has such high levels of infection that people should return to indoor masking. Meanwhile, mask mandates and other precautions have vanished, booster campaigns have faded, and most Americans have concluded the pandemic is all but over. I totally understand people's COVID exhaustion, said Rex Hupke in USA Today, but the virus But with the virus actively spreading, we need to defend ourselves. Boosting will keep you out of the hospital, and donning a mask is just the ethical, neighborly thing to do. In the Midwest, I see very few masks in indoor public spaces, and one word comes to mind: selfish. Voluntary masking is fine, said the New York Post in an editorial, but let's not return to the bad old days of mask mandates. As new variants come and go, the best response is to encourage vaccination. Help the truly high risk stay safe and learn to live with COVID. That glib cliche ignores long COVID, said the Washington Post in an editorial. One recent meta survey of 50 COVID studies found that more than 40% of infected people continue suffering from a whole array of cardiovascular, gastrointestinal, and neurological symptoms long after their initial recovery, including difficulty breathing, cough, chest pain, heart palpitations, brain fog, and anxiety and depression. Even if fewer people die, continuing waves will add to the lasting scar on the nation's health. Long COVID is often terrible, said Ross Douthat in the New York Times, but the fear of it still shouldn't rule your life. We don't hide at home to avoid the viruses and bacteria that can cause chronic illnesses such as multiple sclerosis and Lyme disease. Risk and illness are part of life. Since COVID is now evidently with us for good, we should continue to look for ways to treat and cure while otherwise trying to live our lives as normally as possible. Too many people are falling into binary thinking about COVID, that precautions are 100% effective or they're useless, said Melody Schreiber in the New Republic. While masking, ventilation, vaccination, and testing won't eradicate the virus, they're proven, highly effective tools for preventing its spread and reducing the possibility of endless waves that may repeatedly infect us all with unknown health consequences. Many Americans have succumbed to the urge to move beyond the pandemic, but we shouldn't forget what we've endured, how many people we've lost, and what's at stake. If we cannot or will not remember, the virus will continue reminding us every few months. Here's our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for guilt, with the return of a dozen religious idols that had been stolen from a Hindu temple in Uttar Pradesh, India. The thieves explained in a note to temple staff that we have not been able to sleep, eat, or live peacefully, and are returning your valuables. It was a good week for technology. After a group of students at Johns Hopkins Whiting School of Engineering announced the invention of edible adhesive tape to hold messy tacos, burritos, and wraps together. It was a good week for democracy. After British ornithologists found that a flock of jackdaws will take a voice vote before deciding democratically where and when to fly, enabling hundreds of birds to perform cohesive collective departures from the roost. Whether such a system could work in human communities remains to be seen. It was a bad week for coveting after Texas Senator Ted Cruz expressed bewilderment at the A-list dating record of Saturday Night Live star Pete Davidson. How come that dude gets all of these, like, hot women? Wondered the wildly attractive Cruz, 51. It's a bad week for the People's Convoy after the movement of right-wing truck drivers who tried and failed to shut down Washington, D.C., declared victory from outside the city, and said any further protest will be done on an individual basis. And it was a bad week for Freudian slips when former President George W. Bush, 75, gave a speech in which he denounced Russia's wholly unjustified and brutal invasion of Iraq, of the Ukraine, In explaining his gaffe, Bush ruefully added, 75. briefing is titled Life After Adoption. Abortion opponents say unwanted pregnancies should end in adoption. What happens when a child is given up? Are all unwanted babies adopted? No. Despite a strong demand by couples who can't have children, in a leaked draft opinion of a Supreme Court decision that could enable state abortion bans, Justice Samuel Alito cited a 2002 federal report that nearly 1 million Americans seeking to adopt far outstripped the domestic supply of infants. A birth mother, he argued, thus has little reason to fear that the baby will not find a suitable home. Only about 18,000 American infants are relinquished by new mothers each year, so it's true that there is a strong competition for most of those babies through private adoption or agencies. Directly paying for babies is illegal in every state, but adoptive parents and agencies enter into agreements with pregnant women that provide from $15,000 to $45,000 to cover their legal, medical, and other expenses. Still, not every child put up for adoption finds a good home. What's the problem? Adoptive parents generally want the youngest, healthiest, least troubled children possible. They also have clear racial preferences. New York University economist Alan Collard Wexler found in 2010 that on average, it was $8,000 more expensive to adopt a white baby than a black one. Among babies adopted in 2020, according to Statista Research, 29,325 were white, 11,631 were Hispanic, 9,588 were black, 5,304 were mixed race. The racial disparity may partly reflect the fact that black teens are less likely to put babies up for adoption than white ones, and more likely to have family members raise an unwanted child. But it's also a product of the market pressures within the adoption industry, which is rife with profiteering and exploitation. Pregnant women who sign contracts to turn over their babies have reported being threatened with having to repay all costs if they back out. Special needs infants come at a major discount. Children that no one adopts often wind up in foster care. Today, approximately 400,000 children linger in the foster care system. What's life like in foster care? It's often grim. Nearly half of foster children are eventually reunited with their original parents or guardians, but 10% grow up being shuttled among families and institutions until age 18 or 21, suffering a lot of damage along the way. By age 26, according to a National Conference of State Legislatures report, 36% of those who grew up in foster care have experienced homelessness, and only 8% have earned a college degree. In foster care, life can be bleak. Though child welfare workers usually prefer putting children in family settings, a 2017 study found that about a third of teenage foster children live in group homes or institutions, which advocates have compared to prisons. A 2020 Children's Hospital of Philadelphia study found that children in the system often suffered trauma and were 42% more likely to die young than their peers. If the state were a parent, said University of Texas social work professor Catherine Labrenz, they'd be charged with child neglect. How do adoptees fare? Many wind up in loving, stable homes, but nonetheless can face major emotional challenges and vulnerabilities. Attachments to the birth mother starts in the womb, so even newborns can experience trauma from separation. A 2013 American Academy of Pediatrics study found that adoptees were four times more likely to attempt suicide than their peers. The birth mothers, meanwhile, often experienced strong, lasting feelings of guilt and abandonment. Race can be a complicating factor. About 28% of domestic adoptions are now transracial. And University of Minnesota psychology professor Richard Lee says that white adoptive parents tend to overestimate their preparedness for helping their non-white children navigate racial issues. Between 2008 and 2020, a recent USA Today investigation found 66,000 adoptees were given up and placed in foster care, often because their adoptive families couldn't deal with their medical, social, or emotional problems. What if Roe is repealed? There may not be a major surge in the domestic supply of infants. Many women will simply go to other states for abortions, and a majority who carry them to term will not give up the babies. The 2020 Turnaway study, in which University of California San Francisco researchers followed nearly 1,000 women who sought abortions, found that only 9% of those who were turned away put the babies up for adoption. In the 1950s and 60s, unmarried women were heavily pressured into giving up their newborns. The taboos around single motherhood have weakened, and nearly a quarter of children now live in one-parent households. Many grown adoptees, meanwhile, argue that they deserve a bigger voice in the national conversation and that their existence shouldn't be politicized. It is viciously cruel to use any sort of displacement of a child to push your political agenda, said now 31-year-old adoptee Kirsta Bowman. Adoption does not guarantee a better life. It guarantees a different life. And it's time for a few of the best columns of the week, starting with what drives mass shooters to kill. America's epidemic of mass shootings can't be blamed on mental illness, said Mark Fulman. Politicians and pundits who want to downplay the role of guns and white supremacist ideology are again trying to explain away the Buffalo supermarket massacre by depicting 18-year-old Peyton Gendron as a crazed monster. Gendron allegedly murdered 10 people after he stockpiled weapons, detailed his ideological hatred of black people and others, and surveilled intended targets. It was no spur-of-the-moment attack by a person suffering from delusions. For the past 10 years, I've studied scores of mass shootings, and in most cases, mass shooters don't just suddenly break. They decide. Their violent ideas arise from entrenched grievances, rage, and despair, and their subsequent attacks are often the result of a highly organized and methodical process. Gendron admitted he radicalized himself online, far-right forums promoting replacement theory. Of course, no person who commits a mass shooting is, in a basic sense, mentally healthy, but most have clear motivations, including a desire for vengeance and lasting infamy. Making mental illness the boogeyman is just a way of pretending that nothing can be done. A nation of sleepless teenagers. This generation of teens is the most sleep-deprived population in human history, said Heather Turgeon and Julie Wright. American adolescents are in crisis, with 1 in 3 admitting to persistent feelings of hopelessness and 1 in 5 saying they've seriously considered suicide. A lack of sleep may be a major factor. High schoolers need about 9 hours of sleep a night. Instead, they're getting 6.5. That means today's adolescents are living in a state of severe and chronic sleep debt. Research has shown that chronic sleep deprivation can lead to poor mental health, including anxiety, depression, and almost every psychiatric diagnosis. Several factors are conspiring to deprive teens of sleep: high school starting the day at 7:30 or 8 a.m., in excess of both homework and extracurricular activities, and the ubiquity of technology, social media, and smartphones, which the authors called a wrecking ball for teen sleep. Many teens go to bed with their pinging phones on their pillows. But a lack of sleep is eminently fixable. High school should start later, and families need to set firm rules about sleep, with tech-free bedtimes at about 10 p.m., starting tonight. I don't usually read from this section called It Must Be True. I read it in the tabloids. But a picture here caught my attention, and I thought you'd enjoy it. The picture is a little boy. Looks like he's got a diaper and a shirt on, sitting against a wall. He's holding a hamburger, and beside him is a huge pile of hamburgers wrapped in paper. And the short piece is this. A two-year-old in Texas picked up his mother's smartphone and used DoorDash to order 31 McDonald's cheeseburgers. Kelsey Golden said she was working on the computer when toddler Barrett grabbed her phone, and she didn't realize what he'd done until a driver showed up laden with burgers. Barrett ate only half of one, so she offered the rest up on social media, leading neighbors to stop by for a free lunch. Barrett's splurge came to $91.70, including the $16 tip he checked off. And we'll pick up one more column. This comes from Pakistan. Who will help save us from this heat? The catastrophic heat wave pounding India and Pakistan has laid bare an important truth, said Rafia Zakaria. Our climate crisis doesn't stop at the national borders, so we can suffer for the sins of wealthy people half a world away. The subcontinent is in an environmental cataclysm, sweltering in temperatures over 110 degrees while rationing water and power. Pakistan emits far less carbon dioxide per capita than most countries, yet it hasn't received sufficient resources to confront the climate challenges forced upon it. And it's not just the rich and distant causing the trouble. When poor farmers in Indian Punjab burn straw stubble on their fields, the smog pollutes Pakistan's second largest city, Lahore, making it hard to see even a few feet ahead. This problem of neighbors near and far cannot be neatly solved by the world's centuries-old model of the nation-state. Science can now predict droughts and heat waves, but unless we see the planet as an interconnected political unit, we cannot mitigate climate change in any kind of fair or equitable way. Only planetary cooperation could save us. Unfortunately, the lesson of the pandemic has been that Earth's citizens aren't good at sharing or at working together against a common foe. And we're on to the last word, our feature article, titled this week, In Australia, Trust Won. With more than a million dead of COVID in the U.S., Australia's success in battling the virus is a painful study in the paths we didn't take, said journalist Damien Cave in the New York Times. If the United States had the same COVID death rate as Australia, about 900,000 lives would have been saved. The Texas grandmother who made the perfect pumpkin pie might still be baking. The Red Sox loving husband who ran marathons before COVID might still be cheering at Fenway Park. For many Americans, imagining what might have been will be painful. But especially now at the milestone of 1 million deaths in the United States, the nations that did a better job of keeping people alive show what Americans could have done differently and what might still need to change. Many places provide insight. Japan, Kenya, Norway. But Australia offers perhaps the sharpest comparisons with the American experience. Both countries are English-speaking democracies with similar demographic profiles. In Australia and in the United States, the median age is 38. Roughly 86% of Australians live in urban areas, compared with 83% of Americans. Yet Australia's COVID death rate sits at one-tenth of America's, putting the nation of 25 million people, with around 7,500 deaths, near the top of global rankings in the protection of life. Australia's location in the distant Pacific is often cited as the cause for its relative COVID success. That, however, does not fully explain the difference in outcomes between the two countries, since Australia has long been, like the United States, highly connected to the world through trade, tourism, and immigration. In 2019, 9.5 million international tourists traveled to Australia. Sydney and Melbourne could just as easily have become as overrun with COVID as New York or any other U.S. city. So what went right in Australia and wrong in the United States? For the standard slideshow presentation, it looks obvious. Australia restricted travel and personal interaction until vaccinations were widely available, then maximized vaccine uptake, prioritizing people who were most vulnerable before gradually opening up the country again. From one outbreak to another, there were also some mistakes, breakdowns of protocol in nursing homes that led to clusters of deaths, a vaccine rollout hampered by slow purchasing. And with Omicron and eased restrictions, deaths have increased. But Australia's COVID playbook produced results because of something more easily felt than analyzed at a news conference. Dozens of interviews, along with survey data and scientific studies from around the world, point to a life-saving trait that Australians displayed from the top of government to the hospital floor, and that Americans have shown they lack: trust in science and institutions, but especially in one another. When the pandemic began, 76% of Australians said they were trusted the healthcare system, compared with about 34% of Americans. And 93% of Australians reported being able to get support in times of crisis from people living outside their household. In global surveys, Australians were more likely than Americans to agree that most people can be trusted, a major factor researchers found in getting people to change their behavior for the common good to combat COVID by reducing their movements, wearing masks, and getting vaccinated. Partly because of that compliance, which kept the virus more in check, Australia's economy has grown faster than America's through the pandemic. But of greater import, interpersonal trust, a belief that others would do what was right, not just for the individual, but for the community, saved lives. Trust mattered more than smoking prevalence, health spending, or form of government, a study of 177 countries in The Lancet recently found. And in Australia, the process of turning trust into action began early. Greg Hunt had been Australia's health minister for a couple of years, after working as a lawyer and investor, when his phone buzzed January 20th, 2020. It was Dr. Brendan Murphy, Australia's chief medical officer, and he wanted to talk about a new coronavirus in China. Murphy, a low-key physician and former hospital executive, said there were worrisome signs of human-to-human transmission. "What's your honest, considered advice?" Hunt recalled asking. "I think this has the potential to go beyond anything we've seen in our lifetime," Murphy said. "We need to act fast." The next day, Australia added the coronavirus as a threat with pandemic potential to its biosecurity list, officially setting in motion the country's emergency response. Hunt briefed Prime Minister Scott Morrison, visited the country's stockpile of personal protective equipment, and began calling independent experts for guidance. The first positive case appeared in Australia on January 25th. 5 days later, when the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention confirmed the first human transmission of the virus in the United States, President Donald Trump downplayed the risk. "We think it's going to have a very good ending for us," he said. The same day, Hunt struck a more practical tone. "Border, isolation, surveillance, and case tracing mechanisms are already in place in Australia," he said. Less than 24 hours later, on February 1st, Australia closed its border with China, its largest trading partner. On February 3rd, 241 Australians were evacuated from China and placed in government quarantine for 14 days. While Americans were still gathering in large groups as if nothing were wrong, Australians' COVID containment system was up and running. A full border closure followed. Hotels were contracted to quarantine the trickle of international arrivals allowed in. Systems for free testing and contact tracing were rolled out, along with a federal program that paid COVID-affected employees so they would stay home. Still, with a highly contagious virus, scientists speaking from podiums could do only so much. Experts getting on the same page only matters if people actually trust the actions government is taking and trust their neighbors, said Dr. Jay Varma, director of Cornell's Center for Pandemic Prevention and Response, and a former COVID advisor to Mayor Bill de Blasio of New York. While that type of trust is relatively higher in New York City than in other parts of the U.S., said Varma, who has worked extensively in China and Southeast Asia, I suspect it is still quite low compared to Oceania. The outbreak that many Australians see as their country's greatest COVID test began in late June 2020 with a breakdown in Melbourne's hotel quarantine system. The virus spread into the city and its suburbs from guards interacting with travelers, a government inquiry later found, and within a few weeks, daily case numbers climbed into the hundreds. At Royal Melbourne, a sprawling public hospital built to serve the poor, clusters of infection emerged among vulnerable patients and workers. Case numbers and close contacts spiraled upward. Vaccines were still a distant dream. We recognized right away that this was a disaster we'd never planned for, in that it was a marathon, not a sprint, said Chris McIsaac, Royal Melbourne's director of intensive care. A few weeks in, the system started to buckle. In mid-July, dozens of patients with COVID were transferred from nursing homes to Royal Park, a satellite facility for geriatric care and rehabilitation. Soon, more than 40% of the cases among workers were connected to that small campus. Kirsty Boosing, an infectious disease consultant at the hospital, began to suspect, before scientists could prove it, that the coronavirus was airborne. In mid-July, on her suggestion, Royal Melbourne started giving N95 masks, which are more protective, to workers exposed to COVID patients. In the United States, hospital executives were lining up third-party PPE vendors for clandestine meetings in distant parking lots in a Darwinian all-against-all contest. Royal Melbourne's supplies came from federal and state stockpiles, with guidelines for how distribution should be prioritized. In New York, a city of 8 million people packed closely together, more than 300 healthcare workers had died from COVID by the end of September, with huge disparities in outcomes for patients and workers from one hospital to another, mostly according to wealth. In Melbourne, a city of 5 million with a dense inner core surrounded by suburbs, the masks, a greater separation of patients, and an intense 111-day lockdown that reduced demand on hospital services brought the virus to heel. At Royal Melbourne, not a single worker died during Australia's worst institutional cluster to date. When Australians are asked why they accepted the country's many lockdowns, its once closed international and state borders, its quarantine rules, and then its vaccine mandates for certain professions or restaurants and large events, they tend to voice a version of the same response. It's not just about me. The idea that one's actions affect others is not unique to Australia, and at times, the rules on COVID stirred up outrage. It was a somewhat authoritarian approach, said Dr. Greg Dore, an infectious disease expert at the University of New South Wales in Sydney. There were lots of mandates, lots of fines for breaching restrictions, pretty heavy-handed controlling, including measures that were pretty useless, like policing of outdoor masking. But, he added, the package was effective because the vast majority of Australians stuck with it anyway. The community coming on board and remaining on board through the tough periods of 2020 and even into 2021 was really, really important, Dore said. There is a general sense that for some things, where there are major threats, you just have to come together. During the toughest of COVID times, Australians showed that the national trait of mateship, defined as the bond between equal partners or close friends, was still alive and well. They saw COVID spiral out of control in the United States and Britain and chose a different path. Compliance rates with social distancing guidelines, along with COVID testing, contact tracing, and isolation, held steady at around 90% during the worst early outbreaks, according to modeling from the University of Sydney. In the United States, reductions in mobility, a key measure of social distancing, were less stark, shorter, and more inconsistent, based in part on location, political identity, or wealth. In Australia, rule following was the social norm. It was Mick Fanning, a surfing superstar, who did not question the need to stay with his American wife and infant in a small hotel room for 14 days of quarantine after a trip to California. It was border officials canceling the visa of Novak Djokovic, the top male tennis player in the world, for failing to follow a COVID vaccine mandate, leading to his eventual deportation. It was also all the Australians who lined up to get tested, who wore masks without question, who turned their phones into virus trackers with check-in apps, who set up food services for the old, infirm, or poor in lockdowns, or who offered a place to stay to women who had been trapped in their homes with abusive husbands. At a recent awards luncheon in Melbourne for people who make a difference during COVID, those were the kinds of people being celebrated. Jody McBurnan, director of epidemiology at the Doherty Institute, was the only scientist lauded at the event. Care is so undervalued, she said. This was all about the power of care. More than 95% of Australian adults are fully vaccinated, with 85% of the total population having received two doses. In the United States, that figure is only 66%. The arrival of the Omicron variant, which is more transmissible, has sent Australia's case numbers soaring. But with most of the population inoculated, deaths are ticking up more slowly. In last week's federal election, COVID was far down the list of voter concerns. We learned that we can come together very quickly, said Denise Hindjus, Royal Melbourne's executive director for nursing, whose title in 2020 was COVID commander. There's a high level of trust among our people. A version of this story was originally published in the New York Times. Here's one of the obituaries for you. The baseball scribe who lifted the game to poetry, Roger Angel, 1920 to 2022. Roger Angel was widely considered the greatest baseball writer of his time, even though that wasn't his day job. In 1962, the New Yorker sent its erudite fiction editor to Florida to cover spring training and New York's new club, the Mets. Angel would report from the bleachers for the next 6 decades, publishing first-person essays filled with evocative, often hilarious imagery. Catcher Carlton Fisk came out of his crouch like an aluminum extension ladder stretching for those house eaves, he wrote. Pitcher Dick Hall threw with a sidearm that suggests a man feeling under his bed for a lost collar stud. Although Angel resisted sentimentality, he loathed Field of Dreams, his baseball writing was packed with subtext. Fans cheered for the hapless Mets, he wrote, thanks to a wry, half-understood recognition that there is more Met than Yankee in every one of us. Angel was born in Manhattan to a baseball fan father who eventually led the American Civil Liberties Union, said the New York Times. His mother, Katerina, became the New Yorker's founding fiction editor in 1925. The couple divorced when he was a child, and his mother married E.B. White, the renowned New Yorker essayist and author of Charlotte's Web. Angel attended Harvard, then served in the Air Force as a magazine editor. He began writing short fiction for the New Yorker in 1944 and joined the staff in 1956, said the Washington Post. Known as a nurturing editor, he helped mold the stories of generations of writers, including Vladimir Nabokov and Ann Beatty. Although revered for his breadth of wisdom, Angel was hardly stuck in the past, said the New Yorker. He continued reporting deep into his 90s, including about old age. An essay about yearning for romantic connection at 93 became one of the most read pieces in New Yorker history, and his sense of wonder about baseball never faded. It is foolish and childish, Angel wrote in 1977, to obsess over anything so insignificant and patently contrived as pro sports. But, he added, what is left out of this calculation, it seems to me, is the business of caring. Caring deeply and passionately, really caring, which is a capacity or an emotion that has almost gone out of our lives. And we'll flip on over to the Talking Points page. We have an article titled, Fetterman, the Democrats' Hooded Hero. Have Democrats finally found their answer to Trumpism, asks Kara Vaught in Rolling Stone. That's what many of them are asking after Pennsylvania's Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman's resounding victory in the state Senate primary. Fetterman's centrist Democratic opponent, Connor Lamb, is a clean-cut former Marine and prosecutor, but voters overwhelmingly preferred the 6'9" stature, tattooed, bald, bearded Fetterman, who campaigned in a hoodie, black Skechers sneakers, and baggy gym shorts. Fetterman's anti-establishment appeal includes support for progressive policies, including universal health care, prison reform, and marijuana legalization, and centrist pragmatism, such as supporting both nuclear power and fracking. One big trouble spot, he suffered a stroke just before the primary and had a pacemaker installed, raising questions about his health. In the looming general election battle, Fetterman will face either the Trump-anointed Mehmet Oz or hedge funder David McCormick, and we'll find out whether his label-defying ideology transcends party lines. Don't count on it, said Kyle Smith in National Review. Even if the media really, really wants the Democrat to win in the fall, Fetterman may look like a mechanic lumberjack, but he's a far-left former Bernie Sanders supporter whose politics could qualify him for the squad. Oh, and he chased down a black jogger with a loaded shotgun in 2013, an episode the press would surely mention in every story if he were a Republican. The jogger incident seemed like a non-factor in Fetterman's primary run, said Julia Taruso in the Philadelphia Inquirer. But does it resurface and gain more traction in the general election? In the end, Fetterman's persona may matter more than his past and his policies, said Matthew Iglesias in Bloomberg. In fact, he's now portraying himself as a guy with broadly progressive instincts who identifies with the powerless and the working class, but isn't wedded to specific policies and doesn't engage in wonkery. His strength is the vibes he gives voters, a formula that Democrats can learn from. So far, Fetterman has done none of the things candidates are supposed to do in order to curry favor with party leadership, said the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette in an editorial. But he has made a real connection with Pennsylvania's voters. In so doing, he has earned a mandate to be a leader of Pennsylvania Democrats for the foreseeable future. Disinformation Board, doomed from the start? The Disinformation Governance Board is dead on arrival, said Marcella Garcia in the Boston Globe. And the cause of death was the same plague it was meant to deal with. The new advisory board was created by the Biden administration's Department of Homeland Security just 3 weeks ago, ostensibly to counter lies such as the disinformation coming from Russia ahead of the midterm elections and the claims of human smugglers trying to entice Latin Americans into traveling to the U.S. border. The massive flood of propaganda and false narratives pouring from the internet is a serious problem worth addressing. Yet conservatives immediately attacked the board as an Orwellian ministry of truth that would censor free speech. In its embarrassing rollout, the DHS failed to explain the board's limited purpose and purview, a self-inflicted political wound for the White House. Actually, it was the board's half-baked, absurdly ambitious mission that did it in, said Bradley Devlin in the American Conservative. It was bound to be perceived as a prelude to Big Brother censorship, and the board's appointed executive director, Nina Jankowicz, has a clear partisan bias. She once claimed that a 2020 story about Hunter Biden's laptop was Trump-driven disinformation. The prevalence of bad information is nothing new, said Barton Swaim in the Wall Street Journal. But with supreme arrogance, liberals presume they alone know what is true and what is false. They've embraced the dangerous and simple-minded belief that the primary factor separating their side from the other side isn't ideology, principle, or moral vision, but information. If only the left could police falsehoods, we'd all be liberals, share their objective pro-science COVID policies, and applaud the closing of schools during the pandemic. The board was a doomed idea from the start, said Sam Adler Bell in New York Magazine. It doesn't take any great leap of conspiratorial thinking to find fault with a disinformation board under the aegis of an agency called Homeland Security. No matter who's in power, government officials are professional liars, and their lies become even more brazen whenever national security is invoked. Imagine a disinformation board in the hands of a second Trump administration. If faith in our institutions is to be restored, it won't be accomplished by the government trying to arbitrate fact and fiction. And a few shorter notes. About 95% of the U.S. will see above normal temperatures this summer, according to a forecast from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Below average rainfall is also expected in the West, already trapped in a historic mega drought. Donald Trump has endorsed a woman running for the Michigan State Legislature who wants to ban contraception and impose the Christian moral order. Jackie Eubanks said abortion and gay marriage lead to chaos and destruction, and that contraception gives people the false sense of security that they can have consequence-free sex. COVID killed more police officers in the line of duty in 2021 than any other single cause, according to preliminary data released by the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund. Last year was the deadliest for officers in 90 years, with 458 deaths, More than 300 of those were from COVID, which officers may have contracted on the job. Larry Ellison, the billionaire co-founder of the software firm Oracle, participated in a conference call shortly after the 2020 election in which participants strategized about trying to overturn Donald Trump's loss. Others on the November 14th call included Fox News host Sean Hannity and Senator Lindsey Graham. Ellison, who's been ranked the world's 11th richest person, was a major Trump fundraiser. On the poll watch, 34% of Americans say the pandemic is over, including 67% of Republicans and 10% of Democrats. 74% think COVID will disrupt daily life until at least the end of 2022. And we'll finish out with a quote from comedian George Carlin, quoted in the New York Times, who says, "It's called the American dream because you have to be asleep to believe it." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information, or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.